invitation to a talk here in Dallas about the discovery of superconductivity almost 100 years ago. I think it's 18 days to go. And here we have a painting of our main character, Heike Kamerlingh Onnes. It was painted in 1904 by his brother, Menzo. And also we have here a 7 Tesla MRI scanner of Leiden Medical Hospital, by far the most important commercial application of superconductivity. Superconductivity is linked with the Meissner effect, as we all know, perhaps, and a nice opportunity for public outreach is the levitator, and this boy in the Leiden marketplace already got his sticker, "I have been levitated." Kamerlingh Onnes started in Leiden in 1882. His scientific mission was to test the molecular laws of his friend Johannes Diederik van der Waals. And then you have to think of the equation of state, the law of corresponding states, behavior of mixtures, and so on. But as a physicist, of course, you prefer...
This is bumping quite a lot. Try putting it over here.
Well, as a physicist, of course, you prefer simple molecules, diatomic ones, nitrogen, oxygen, hydrogen, or even better, noble gases, in particular helium. But these noble gases were discovered on Earth by William Ramsay in London only in 1895. The problem with these gases was that the critical temperature is very low, and only below critical temperature a fluid is possible. Oxygen has a critical temperature of 155 degrees Kelvin, hydrogen 33 Kelvin, and helium only 5 Kelvin. So Kamerlingh Onnes has had to build up a cryogenic laboratory from scratch. And here we have the installation for liquid oxygen completed in 1894. It's a cascade with 3 refrigerating cycles. And anyone who entered the cryogenic laboratory and beheld the profusion of tubes, taps, gas flasks, gas holders, liquefiers, dual flasks, cryostats, clattering pumps, droning engines, glass blowing and other workshops, instruments and appliances for scientific research, would have felt as if he had come to a factory, a cold factory. Well, in a cryogenic laboratory, it's all about temperature. But these kinds of temperature, of course, are rather useless, below zero. Scientifically spoken, the best way to measure temperature is with a gas thermometer filled with liquid hydrogen or helium under low pressure, and using Gay-Lussac's law in combination with all kinds of corrections for non-ideal gases, false volume, expansion coefficients of the glass, etc. A gas thermometer is a very accurate and reliable instrument, and the only problem is that it's rather cumbersome in use. So you have to wait a long time for reaching equilibrium and so on. So a secondary thermometer calibrated against a gas thermometer would be very welcome. And resistance thermometers proved to be ideal secondary thermometers. Resistance thermometers were introduced by William Siemens in the 1860s, and especially Hughes Callender propagated their use in science. In 1902, they were introduced in the Leiden cryogenic lab, and thin wires of gold or platinum proved to be the best. And here we have some of the Leiden resistance thermometers as they are kept now in Museum Boerhaave in Leiden. The first one to work with them was Jacob Clay, a PhD student of Kamerlingh Onnes. And in the 1920s, Clay, by the way, played a minor role in the discovery of the latitude effect of cosmic rays. Here we have a page from the communications from the physical laboratory of the University of Leiden, Kamerlingh Onnes' own journal. Meiling was another assistant involved in calibrating resistance thermometers put into a hydrogen cryostat against a hydrogen gas thermometer. The wire was mounted around a glass cylinder with the hydrogen reservoir inside this cylinder, and the resistance was measured using a Wheatstone bridge and later on overlapping shunts in combination with a differential galvanometer were used. Well, the question was, what would happen to the resistance of a metal as its temperature approaches absolute zero? And that was an open question those days. A question of practical importance can metal wires still be used as thermometers at very low temperatures? If the resistance goes to a constant value at very low temperatures, that would render platinum wires useless as secondary thermometers. But there was also a question of theoretical importance. There were two rivaling theories. In the first place, William Thomson, Lord Kelvin, the great physicist from Great Britain, had put forward in 1901 his idea of electrons freezing upon the atoms or ions, so no mobility anymore and the resistance goes up to infinity. On the other hand, there was the German theorist Paul Drude, who had developed 1 year later his model of a free electron gas in a metal, and according to this theory, the electrical resistance linearly goes down to zero with decreasing temperature. So Kamer and Onnes, who tinkered with a kind of theoretical Planck vibrators model himself, starting with the new Einstein quantum model for specific heats, had every reason to set up clever experiments to decide these matters. For the first time, the quantum world was connected to low-temperature phenomena. The liquefaction of helium on the 10th of July 1908 opened a new area of extreme low temperatures. The lower limit was put down from 14 Kelvin, solid hydrogen, to about 1.5 Kelvin. And this picture was taken on the 10th of July. And on the right, we have the present helium liquefactor as it is kept and shown in Museum Boerhaave nowadays. The next important requirement was transferring helium from the liquefier, which lacked adequate space for experiments, to a separate cryostat. On Saturday, 12 March 1910, the first attempt was made to transfer helium to a separate cryostat. The only content of the cryostat consisted of a double-walled container in which an even smaller one was connected to an impressive battery of pumps. Because there was nothing but glass inside this container, the experiment worked well and the new low-temperature record was registered about 1.1 Kelvin. And on the right, on this picture drawing, we is given of the cryostat consisting of several containers of glass fitting inside each other. And most of the containers are carried out in the form of thermos bottle or dewar. And the outer vessel contains alcohol of 30 to 40 degrees Celsius, pink color, to prevent condensation of water vapor on the glass. And the outer dewar, blue, contained liquid air. The middle one, green, liquid hydrogen. And the inner dewar, C, was supposed to be filled with liquid helium in red, coming from the liquefier on the left, entering through the double wall tube D. And the bottom part of insert B was double walled and could be filled with liquid helium by condensation of helium gas. And the left part of the drawing shows the liquefier with the Thomson valve on upside clearly visible. The goal of the next experiment, 4 months later, was to continue measuring the resistance against the temperature for the platinum resistor that had previously been calibrated down to 14 Kelvin. But the experiment failed because the extra heat capacity of the built-in resistor caused violent boiling and fast evaporation of the freshly transferred helium. So it was decided to drastically change the transfer system, and that would take another 9 months. Well, here we have a drawing made by Harm Kamer and Onnes, Heike's nephew, and we see chief technician Flynn on his back, and right of him, the glassblower Kesselring and some blue-collar boys, trainees of the in-house school of instrument makers. And the painting, too, on the right is made by Harm Kamer and Onnes. Kamer and Onnes wanted to check his Planck vibrators model at the lowest temperatures and did not want to wait the 9 months till the new liquid transfer system was ready, liquid helium transfer system. Therefore, he decided to expand the original 1908 helium liquefier so that it could house a platinum resistor. And such a resistor was about 10 centimeters long and 1 centimeter in diameter. Thus, on 2 December 1910, he made the first measurement of the resistance for a metal at liquid helium temperatures. Cornelis Dorsman assisted with the temperature measurements and student Gilles Holst operated the Wheatstone Bridge with the mirror galvanometer. That piece of equipment, being very sensitive for vibrations, had been placed in a separate room far away from the cryogenic laboratory with all its heavy thumping pumps. The outcome of the experiment was striking, as you see. It's shown in this figure together with some older data of gold resistors. The resistance of platinum became constant below 4.25 Kelvin. There was no longer any doubt that Lord Kelvin's theory was wrong. The electromobility did not freeze out near absolute zero. The resistance had fallen to a residual value that presumably depended on the impurity of the wires. And those impurities could be either intrinsic or caused by the drawing process for the fabrication of thinner and longer wires to get higher resistances. In view of his model, Planck vibrators with a certain frequency, Kamerlingh-Onnes concluded that resistors of sufficient pure platinum or gold should become zero at liquid helium temperatures. But the best choice to test his model was mercury, because by means of repeated distillation, that metal could be made extremely pure. And at the beginning of April 1911, the new cryostat was ready for its first cool down. It was a masterpiece of technical design, demonstrating the amazing level of glass-blowing skill and fine mechanical construction. The transfer tube had been replaced by a double-walled, vacuum-pumped glass siphon, externally cooled by a counterflow of liquid air forced through a copper capillary coil wound around it. The liquefier and the cryostat could be separated from each other simply by closing a valve operated from above. Another important contraption necessary to establish a well-defined temperature at the site of the measuring devices was a stirrer connected to a magnet at the top of the cryostat that could be moved up and down by motor. The action of valve and stirrer could be directly followed through uncoated strips in the silvered vacuum glasses. The main purpose of the experiment was to test the transfer of liquid helium to the experimental cryostat. But according to notebook number 56, inside the cryostat were installed a helium gas thermometer, a gold resistor, a silver-gold therm element, a mercury resistor, and a constantin resistor. So experiments could be done just in case the helium transfer worked. And here we have the helium cryostat with therm in detail, and the gas thermometer is TH3, and the mercury thermometer is with the ohm sign and mercury, and also the gold resistor is denoted at the lower level. And the stirrer is SB. Nice piece of just equipment. Here we have notebook number 56, kept in Museum Boerhaave. Because Kamerlingh-Onnes made a mistake in writing down the date, 1910, where it should have been 1911, in combination with his terrible handwriting, for many decades it was thought the notebook containing the events leading to the discovery of superconductivity was lost. Thanks to Peter Kess, my colleague at Leiden, the mistake was recognized, so the real story can now be told. The mercury resistor was constructed by connecting seven U-shaped glass capillaries in series, 20 centimeters long, with an inner diameter of 0.07 millimeters, each containing a small mercury reservoir to prevent the wire from breaking during cool down. The electrical connections were made by four platinum feed throughs with thin copper wires. Here they are mercury, but later on, this was a sketch later on. Essentially, the same principle was used on April. So they were platinum feed throughs with thin copper wires leading to the measurement equipment outside the cryostat. And to learn what happened on 8 April 1911, we just have to follow the notes in notebook 56. The experiment started at 7 a.m. with the production of liquid hydrogen, and Kamerlingh-Onnes joined in when they began to circulate helium at 11:20 a.m. The resistance of the mercury indicated the falling temperature. After 30 minutes, the gold resistor was at 140 degrees Celsius, and soon after noon, the gas thermometer denoted 5 Kelvin. The valve also worked very sensitively, and half an hour later, enough helium had been transferred to test the functioning of the stirrer and to measure the very small evaporation heat of helium. The team established that the liquid helium did not conduct electricity and they determined its dielectric constant. Holst made precise measurements of the resistances of mercury and gold, and the temperature was determined by Dorsman. Then they started to reduce the vapor pressure. The helium evaporated very fast due to its small evaporation heat, and they measured the specific heat and stopped at a vapor pressure of 197 millimeters of mercury, corresponding to about 3 Kelvin. And exactly at 4 p.m., says the notebook, the resistances of gold and mercury were determined again. And the letter mercury was in the historic entry, mercury practically zero, the first denote of superconductivity. So now we have a date. The experiments on 8 April 1911 continued into the late afternoon, and at the end of the day, Kamerling Onnes finished with an intriguing notebook entry. Quote, it should be remarked that just before the lowest temperature, about 1.8 Kelvin, was reached, the boiling suddenly stopped and was replaced by evaporation in which the liquid visibly shrank. So, a remarkably strong evaporation at the surface. End of quote. Without realizing it, the Leiden team had observed the superfluid transition of liquid helium at 2.2 Kelvin. Two different quantum transitions had been seen for the first time in one lab on the very same day. And here we have a picture, as you may recognize, of the fountain effect discovered by Jack Allen in 1938. 3 weeks later, Kamerling Onnes reported the results at the regular April meeting of the Dutch Academy of Sciences in Amsterdam. For the resistance of ultra-pure mercury, he first told the audience his model had yielded, Planck vibrators model, three predictions. The first one, at 4.3 Kelvin, the resistance should be much smaller than 14 Kelvin, but still measurable with his equipment. And secondly, it should be not yet be independent of temperature. And in third place, at very low temperatures, it should become zero within the limits of experimental accuracy. Those predictions, Kamerling Onnes concluded, had been completely confirmed by experiments. And a look at the RT graph clarifies why he came to such a conclusion with only three data points at his disposal, 3 Kelvin, 4.3 Kelvin, and 14 Kelvin. Well, thanks to notebook number 56, all kinds of nice stories about the discovery of superconductivity developed over time due to lack of real information can be put aside as not true. Nice, but not true. For example, in the September 1996 issue of Physics Today, the Leiden physicist Jacobus de Nobel told the story of the blue-collar boy, an apprentice of the Leiden School of Instrument Makers, founded by Kamerling Onnes, who had fallen asleep. As a consequence, the temperature raised slowly until it reached the transition point and normal resistance returned. Suddenly, according to the story, it was understood that all those short circuits in different helium runs were no short circuits at all. Indeed, a nice story, but completely wrong, because let's have a look at the notebook. On 23 May, it reads, all regarding installation had been disconnected from electrical wiring in building. It was feared that previous times this could have been of influence. Remains now to suspect paper and paraffin. Evaporation seems decreased at these low temperatures. Now explored point between 190 millimeters mercury and 760 millimeters hydrogen. That's between 3 Kelvin and 4.3 Kelvin. Because found resistance zero at just chosen point 3.2 Kelvin. At 4.00 Kelvin, not yet anything to notice of rising resistance. At 4.05, not yet either. At 4.12, resistance begins to appear. So it was deliberately raised and not by Blue Boy. And the experiment was done with increasing rather than decreasing temperatures, because that way the temperature changes slowly and the measurements could be done under more controlled conditions. No sleeping boy at all. But it's, of course, it's a nice story. The next October experiment produced the historic plot, shown here, of the abrupt appearance of mercury resistance at 4.20 Kelvin. The part of the plot above the temperature, transition temperature, is of particular interest because it shows a gradual increase in this temperature beyond the jump. To obtain those data, the LIDAR team had to go beyond the normal boiling point of helium, and they did it by closing the helium inlet valve so that the vapor pressure could rise and thus raise the boiling temperature. And from the sudden jump, it was clear that a totally new and unexpected phenomenon had been discovered, which Cameron Onnes called supraconductivity. Just 1 week later, Cameron Onnes reported in Brussels to the elite of the physics world at the very first of the historic Solvay conferences his discovery. And in the discussion, Paul Langevin from France asked if other properties of the substance displayed similar sudden changes as would be the case if mercury underwent a structural modification at 4.20 Kelvin. Apparently, he was thinking of a phase transition, and he might also perhaps have in mind a structural phase transition. So, who discovered superconductivity? Up to this very day, some people think that Holst is the real discoverer. He shouldn't have told Cameron Onnes. Don't tell your supervisor. I hope I've made clear in my presentation that this is completely nonsense, that the facts tell a different story, a story of teamwork. Cameron Onnes, director of the Leiden Physics Department and founder of the cryogenic laboratory, took the initiative to the mercury measurements. Flynn, chief technician of the cryogenic laboratory, was responsible, together with Cameron Onnes, for the building of the cryogenic apparatus. Dorsman, an assistant, handled the gas thermometer in order to do the temperature measurements. Holst, another assistant, measured the resistance of the mercury using a Wheatstone bridge, or something to be compared with that. And a mirror galvanometer in a separate room, far away from the thundering pumps. He noticed, of course, as the first one, the sudden swing of the galvanometer. Kesselring, master glassblower, built the capillaries filled with frozen mercury. Remarkable was that all the publications with superconductivity had a single author, Cameron Onnes. And that was not uncommon those days, but of course, Cameron Onnes could also have mentioned co-authors, but he didn't do so. Well, of course, he acknowledged the most valuable help by Holst, Dorsman, Flim, and Kesselring on various occasions. And here we have all of them on the light. The left above is the second from the right is Dorsman. Right above is Holst. On the left on the left side Flim, and on the right side Cameron Onnes. And here's the glass blowing room in the laboratory. And on the left at the upright position is Kesselring, who came from Germany. The Leiden cryogenic laboratory, with its monopoly on liquid helium until 1923, was a first example of big science, you can mention. And here we have Flim again. The mercury period was closed in December 1912. The Leiden team discovered that lead and tin were superconductors with transition temperatures near 6 Kelvin and 3.8 Kelvin, respectively. These discoveries came as something of a relief. Since the experiments were continued with these materials without worrying about laboratory problems peculiar to mercury, double distillation, broken threads, and very cumbersome cool-down procedures. And here we have the first superconducting coil made out of lead wire. An experiment 17 January 1914 revealed that the destructive effect of a magnetic field on superconductivity, For lead, the threshold value at 4.25 Kelvin was only 600 Gauss. Very low field. That must have been a great disappointment to Kamerlingh-Onnes, because on several occasions, for instance at the Third International Congress of Refrigeration in Washington, Chicago in 1913, he had dreamt aloud about coils made of superconducting material that could produce magnetic fields as high as 100,000 Gauss, or 10 Tesla. Well, thanks to niobium-titanium wires first assembled in the early 60s, nowadays we do have strong superconducting magnets, and they are used in particle accelerators, they are used in detectors, for example, the ATLAS detector of the Large Hadron Collider in CERN, and also in MRI scanners, still being fed with liquid helium today. And I'd like to end my talk with the persistent current experiment of 1914. A current was induced in a superconducting lead ring and lead coil, and the half-life of the diminishing of the current, measured with the help of a compass needle placed outside the cryostat, turned out to be several days, putting a still lower limit to the residual resistance of the ring. And here we have a drawing of Flynn at the front. In practice, of course, the level of the compass needle in the middle and a kind of compensation on the right were on the same level as the superconducting ring inside the cryostat on the left. And on the right of this picture, we have the situation from above. And Paul Ehrenfest, the Leiden theoretical physicist, well, he was flabbergasted, as you may read for yourself by this citation of a letter to Lorentz. Well, Kamerlingh-Onnes would have liked to perform the experiment at the Academy of Sciences in Amsterdam, the experiment of this persistent current, but because a helium cryostat separated from the helium liquefactor had to wait until the 1920s, that was impossible those days. But in 1932, Willem Kaesom, the successor of Kamerlingh-Onnes, flew to London with a separate helium cryostat to show the persistent current experiment started in Leiden with a kind of 300 currents in lead induced in the cryogenic laboratory in Leiden. And he flew to London to the Royal Institution, where on a Friday evening lecture this effect was demonstrated. And here we see Kaesom on the right and Flynn and Kaesom together with the cryostat. Well, just a picture of the Leiden laboratory. Nowadays, it's a law faculty house there. It used to be called the Kamerlingh-Onnes Laboratory from the 30s. In the middle, there was the place where Holst was doing this measurements with the Wheatstone Bridge. And on the right side, at the end of the laboratory, there was the cryogenic department. There was some 30 meters away from it because of this thundering pumps effect. Here we have a view of the Museum Boerhaave, where the equipment of Kamerlingh-Onnes is housed nowadays and can be seen. And a few weeks ago, we started a temporary exhibition in Leiden, Mercury Practically Zero, the discovery of superconductivity. And to end, on the 8th of April, there will be a one-day symposium in Leiden to commemorate 100 years of superconductivity. And on that occasion, two plaques will be revealed, one given by Philips Research, because of Flynn, of course, because of Holst, of course, because Holst was the first director of Philips Research in 1914, and one by the IEEE, shown here, and maybe some of you will join this party. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for a lovely talk. We would welcome questions on the historical aspects. There are microphones that you can go to ask the questions.
Kamerlingh-Onnes was pushing matter into a physical regime which no one else had ever explored. Did he get any kind of public reaction similar to the one which arose recently concerning the LHC, that this was a very dangerous operation?
Sorry, Yes, the question is, what sort of public recognition did Kamerlingh Onnes get as a result of his work?
Okay, well, the public reaction was the Nobel Prize, but he didn't get the Nobel Prize for his superconductivity experiments, but for his liquid helium experiments. Well, he was recognized as a superb scientist and also a lot of credentials about it, but the Leiden municipality well, was more or less against his laboratory inside in the center of town, because in 1896 they discovered he had all kinds of explosive devices in his laboratory, and ethylene and all those gases and so on. So they tried to get him out, but after a very long procedure in which Kamerlingh Onnes had to shut down his cryogenic laboratory for 2 years, he won and could go on. But exactly in those years, Dewar liquefied hydrogen, so he had lost that battle before he could even start. But on the central level, he was recognized, and also at the main public recognized his outstanding achievements very well, yes.
Sounds like OSHA was in effect at that time. Are there questions? If not, thank you very much. Okay.